Mr. Cohn.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. It's really an honor to be here before this august body. I have the privilege today of really having a great team of amici attorneys on my side. So for that reason, I know that I did ask for 30 minutes. I may not need to use all of it because I do want to let the very talented attorneys who are on my side have an opportunity to give their perspectives with regard to their individual constituencies.
Very wise call.
Thank you, Your Honor. Another thing that I want to do before I get right into rebutting some of the things that were said by opposing counsel is just to give a little bit of an overview of how this court, I believe, has ruled before, which sort of led to the Open Public Records Act. And not directly, there was a gap in between, but in the Loigman decision, which we obviously cite over and over for the non-exhaustive six-factor test, shortly after it gives that test, it does say, it's sort of an acknowledgement that the test is a bit cumbersome. It says that perhaps at some point in the future, the legislature will create a public records law that instead of merely asking the courts to balance the interests, which could be very difficult, there's at least six factors, I think, as Your Honor has intimated, which means that there could theoretically be more factors. So that law was OPRA. And when the legislature enacted OPRA, they were very clear that they wanted to keep the common law around. That was something that was mentioned fairly extensively in plaintiff's briefing. However, I think that it missed the point to some degree, which is that the legislature also had the opportunity at that time, if they wanted to abrogate the American rule or create some sort of special exemption or some special application by which common law requests for public access should be entitled to attorney's fees, the legislature certainly had the opportunity to do it when it enacted that law. What defendant believes that the legislature was trying to do was really to follow up on Loigman and say, we're going to create a law which is going to take a lot of the guesswork out of this. And in Loigman, by the way, it does cite to a case by the Appellate Division, Beck versus Bluestein, which it cites to, and I believe quotes, that the exquisite balancing test, whatever verbiage they use, is something to be performed by courts. So it doesn't say in that case that it's something to be performed by the custodian. Now, the concept of the custodian, I think, became more pronounced as a result of the Open Public Records Act, which defines custodian in the municipal context to mean a municipal clerk. As Your Honors, I think, are well-versed in our briefs, I'm not going to beat to death the point, as we did in our supplemental brief, that municipal clerks don't have law degrees. They're largely in ministerial positions in terms of record keeping, writing. And the idea that a municipal clerk is going to be expected, frankly, with or without legal counsel, especially without legal counsel, and you've got 570 municipalities in New Jersey, which you need to account for as well, in addition to the fact that you've got many other public entities in New Jersey that are subject to OPRA, apart from municipalities. So the idea that a municipal clerk, since we're talking about a municipality here, is going to figure out a six-factor, non-exhaustive Loigman test, which theoretically could require them to also add factors, right? Then that's somehow analogous to things that we could think about that could be possibly in an OPRA analysis, something that a clerk may wrestle with. From all of our common experience, we know that most OPRA cases are not going to require anywhere near that level of analysis. Moreover, probably no OPRA case would ever require that level of analysis. Even the most extreme example of whether an investigation is by turning over investigatory records would be inimical to the public interest. That's one factor. That's not six non-exhaustive factors. And then you add the Rivera decision, I think you got five more factors when you're talking about internal affairs records. So now you've got 11 factors for clerks, non-exhaustive, to think about. So under that rubric, you know, I'd say, you know, what we were trying to advance at the appellate division was don't abrogate the American rule, but we were all reading the trial court found that the statement of this court in Mason was not dicta, right? If you read the first ruling, there wasn't even any legal analysis whatsoever. If you read the transcripts, the trial court judge said, just to be clear, I am relying on Mason. So the trial court judge, you know, I think departed from where we're all sort of on the same page at today, which is that Mason was not intended by this court to be a controlling statement of law relative to the common law. So what the appellate division did by trying to apply Mason as best as it could was to sort of come up with a middle ground approach. I think that's one of essentially three, perhaps four approaches if we add what Judge Sabatino stated that this court could theoretically adopt. There might be more. The first one would be what plaintiffs champion, which is a compulsory, 100% all cases, abrogation of the common law. If the requester obtains disclosure of documents under the common law, even if it's been successfully denied under OPRA, they get counsel fees. I believe we've already, based on questions that have been asked by Justice Patterson, I'm not going to repeat that, you know, colloquy, because I won't be able to do it justice. But basically, that creates an untenable situation. As Judge Sabatino asked, can I put a dollar figure analysis on it? I can't do that. But what I can tell you is, by having represented public entities for more than 15 years, this statement that Mr. Cafferty talks about, it's a cute quip from this appellate division case that says that, I guess, public entities have inexhaustible resources and that requesters will be in a quixotic battle against municipalities or public entities with regard to fighting over records. That may have been the case. I'm not sure what appellate division case that was. I doubt it was ever the case. It's really not the case now. It's certainly not the case for the Township of Neptune, the defendant in this case. The Township of Neptune is an aid municipality. It's, you know, there's a 2% budget cap on every single municipality in New Jersey. The fees that I've been getting paid on this case are $150 an hour, which I think is somewhere about half of what Gannett's been paying the most junior associates in plaintiff's law firm, and somewhere closer to what they've been paying library staff than what they pay Mr. Cafferty.
Mr. Cohn, can I ask you a question going back to where you began your argument? I didn't want to interrupt your opening statement. I'm wondering about the interplay between legislative action and the common law. Typically, there's an area of common law that the court has addressed over time, and then the legislature certainly has the right to step in and supplant the common law, as it's done in a number of areas, whether it's tort liability with respect to spectator sports or ski slopes and a broad array of cases like that. Or in the case of OPRA, it can say, we're legislating as to this and we're leaving alone the common law. Is there a middle ground where the legislature can say, we're going to legislate about the common law without preempting it? Do you understand what I'm asking?
If what you're asking is whether what the legislature did by preserving OPRA is something I've seen before, I haven't seen anything like it specifically.
But you suggested that the legislature could have said, and we're going to make attorney's fees available in common law theories. We're not going to supplant them. We're going to allow them to survive on their own. Has that happened elsewhere?
Not to my knowledge, Chief Justice. The only reason I raise that argument, even though counsel didn't say it during oral argument today, it was in both the ACLU brief and, I think, more prominently in plaintiff's brief, that 47:1A-6.
We're familiar with the argument.
Okay. So, I mean, I was really sort of addressing that argument, even though it wasn't really made today. I'm not familiar with others. I'll tell you, I do a lot of employment law, so I am familiar with the law against discrimination, having counsel fees. I'm familiar with Conscientious Employee Protection Act.
But that's counsel fees in statutory cases.
Right.
It has nothing to do with common law.
Right. So
one analogy to what the chief is talking about is the product liability law statute, which preserves the common law for issues other than those that the legislature specifically did. But there is no common, there's no statutory award of fees under that.
The one with which I'm familiar, justices, would be the Pierce versus Ortho Pharmaceutical. Mm-hmm. Common law claim for wrongful termination still exists as a principle, but in reality, most attorneys pursue the Conscientious Employee Protection Act instead of that common law claim. And this court has never sanctioned attorneys' fees under a Pierce wrongful termination theory. I'm less familiar with what Your Honor is talking about.
There's I've never been any issue with respect to fees under that statute, but it was one. The reason I raise it is because it's one where they did say we're preserving the common law other than the issues we've dealt with.
Go
ahead.
To get back to a point that was raised earlier, in the handful of times that this court has modified the common law, the American rule, in order to award fees, almost universally it's dealt with really bad faith conduct. The one, in the family cases with regard to lawyers who are breaching their fiduciary duty, in legal malpractice cases where the amount of money that you pay your lawyer is really your damages because you're suing them for malpractice. So under, I believe it's Saffer.
But Saffer, that's an attorney. You're talking about the Saffer award of attorney's fees in that regard? Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Right. So I think those cases are distinguishable from this. Whether or not you want to call it a penalty or something else, the reality of the situation is that if the Township of Neptune had to absorb the cost that Gibbons has incurred in this lawsuit up until today's date, I think they're going to have to move budget items around because even at the law division, I mean, I believe it was cut because they lost on Oprah. I want to say, I don't want to misspeak, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Then it was cut down to something like $130,000 because they didn't prevail under Oprah. And then the trial court judge cut it another $40,000. So it was about $90,000 when we appealed it, which leads me to Judge Sabatino's question about whether if a public entity were to appeal common law disclosure rulings, whether that would be an appropriate time to award counsel fees. The first thing I want to say about it is that wouldn't apply to this case, because to be very clear, there has not been one appeal in this entire case in which the plaintiff respondent was not one of the appellants, because they've appealed Oprah consistently. And then the other part about it is that it's not clear that the township would have appealed the initial decision were it not for its disagreement with the trial courts having awarded $90,000 worth of counsel fees.
So they've come in with a broader argument that with respect to common law claims, it's a hollow right if there are not attorney's fees available. Tell us, what are the consequences if a township clerk wrongfully, not in bad faith, but wrongfully denies a common law right of access request?
Well, the reality of the situation, Chief Justice, is that, if you read all the briefs, everybody's coming up with worst-case scenarios. But the reality is a clerk is going to do their job the right way. And you can even see that in the example that Ms. Griffin gave about the Star Ledger compiling data on dash cam videos that they obtained after the Lyndhurst ruling. Well, the Lyndhurst ruling didn't award counsel fees, right? And every time that people requested dash cam videos thereafter, apparently the clerks must have been turning over the dash cam videos in order for the Star Ledger to come up with that.
So step back, and if you could help with my question. If a township denies a common law right of access claim and is wrong in doing so, what are the consequences?
Well, very theoretically likely is that there can never nevertheless be a lawsuit, or it could be brought to the attention of the township attorney of other people who are ranking in the township. The clerk is generally not the administrator, although in some cases they can be. Even the administrator is subject to the governing body. Nobody wants a clerk who's making improper, unlawful decisions. Now, you know, there have to be distinguished mistakes, obviously, from bad faith, but if a clerk is making...
Leave bad faith out for a moment. Their argument, of course, is they're not going to be filing these lawsuits if there's no right of counsel fees at the end of the day. So short of a lawsuit, are there any consequences for a clerk, not in bad faith, wrongfully denying these requests?
Sure, the clerk's not doing their job. If a clerk is wrongfully denying requests, they could be subject to discipline because a clerk's not doing their job at that point. And you know, even though plaintiffs say that they won't file lawsuits, they could still file under Oberend the common law. A judge could still rule that the common law was not properly followed, and maybe the clerk didn't contact the attorney, and the clerk just turned over the records. A clerk's going to get in trouble probably for doing that. Clerks have to work to obtain tenure. They don't get tenure until they're reappointed after 4 years. I could see situations where it's very likely that clerks could hurt their ability to obtain tenure and reappointment if they're making mistakes in doing their job. It's just like if a clerk makes a mistake in terms of not adequately preparing meeting minutes, which could be a problem under the Open Public Meetings Act, or not you know, putting things that are supposed to be documented. So when clerks aren't doing their job properly, they could be subject to disciplinary actions, and obviously not do it. Like if a clerk, just to give that example, were requested a dash cam and they don't ask anybody and they just willy-nilly say, sorry, you can't have it, the clerk is probably going to get in trouble for having done that.
I think at the beginning you were talking about four different options that could exist for fees. I had thought I understood from your briefs that you were agreeing that attorney's fees can be awarded under a common law right of access claim, but that it's a discretionary decision of the trial court, and the trial court has to be able to consider whether fees should be awarded, and that the difference was that the plaintiffs were arguing that they must be awarded in every case and that there is no discretionary decision by the trial court. Was I correctly understanding that?
Yes, you're right, Justice Wainwright, that was the argument that we were making, because between the options of all common law successful requests that ultimately a judge disagrees with the clerk on become counsel fee situations versus a discretionary fee award. The discretionary fee award is a far superior outcome from a public policy perspective because it gives an opportunity, first of all, for judges to be able to take a look and see whether or not, you know, the situation was one where the clerk acted in a manner that wouldn't seem to lend itself to...
Are you saying you were taking the best of a bad options? Who presented the bad options?
Well, I mean, I think the appellate division was reading Mason as saying that counsel fees, absent an apparent theoretical basis.
But I'm just asking what you were arguing in your briefs. I understood in your briefs that you were conceding that in common law cases, fees can be awarded. It's just that the trial court has to have the discretion to consider whether or not they should be awarded in any particular case.
What we argued in our briefs, Justice, was basically that if the appellate division did what it should have done by saying that this is how we view what Mason says to us, and that we don't think that it was supposed to be intended to require fees in all cases, and that a discretionary standard with a fact-sensitive analysis makes more sense, and that then by looking at how they employed the discretionary fact-sensitive analysis, it worked in this case, and it provides a workable manner going forward. I do, however, you know, share the concerns of the amici on our side that, you know, even the discretionary test seems to create an abrogation of the American rule and could create a slippery slope with regard to other common law types of claims. Although, you know, that is obviously something that we argued that, you know, among the bad options, the discretionary one seemed to work better than a compulsory fee award regime.
But a premise of that was that Mason authorizes fee shifting. If that premise is not true, then your position is the same or different?
If Mason does not authorize, then absolutely my position is different in terms of both the appellate division I was basing my brief on the appellate division's decision being correct, that Mason required them, because Mason comes from this court, their superior court, appellate division, they have to follow this court, and if they thought that what this court told, what, how they read Mason, required it, then I was agreeing with them. But if Mason is not saying that, then I would agree that their common law fees should never be allowable, absent the type of 148 standard, which frivolous litigation, bad faith, as my colleague from the Office of the Attorney General will talk about.
Other questions, anyone? No. Anything else you'd like to present? Remember that promise you started with. You're at about 20 minutes.
That's right. I think I covered it. I just, you know, the one thing that I did have a note on, and I think it was covered in questions, was the first impression, just real brief. Obviously, every single common law request is going to be a matter of first impression by its very nature, because the way that it's written in Lawyerman, the Supreme Court is saying under the common law, there needs to be an exquisite balancing test, looking at the interests of the individual as balanced against the interests of the governmental entity. So that's going to be different in every single case, even in the dash cam cases, right? So every single case is essentially a case of first impression. That, other than that, I thank you for the honor of being able to address the court today.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Ms. Becker.
May it please the court. I want to begin by returning to, I think it was Justice Patterson's very first question earlier this morning, which really distills down what plaintiff and amici ask this court to do today. They ask this court to impose a bright-line categorical award of attorney's fees without any legislative guidance, which reflects a wholesale departure from the American rule, as well as a wholesale departure from how this court has in the past treated the creation of exceptions to the American rule in every case where it has ever crafted one. They also ask this court to put the burden of that decision on the state's taxpayers every time the court later sees a case just a little bit differently, exacerbating what is already a difficult proposition to accept is the nature of the common law right of access and the common law records themselves. I don't want to regurgitate everything that's already been said, but there are some points that are very worth repeating with regard to the nature of the test itself and the nature of the records. Plaintiff began his argument today by indicating that there is no apparent theoretical basis to treat OPRA and the common law differently when it comes to attorney's fees. We respectfully disagree. The first thing we're dealing with is the nature of the records themselves. And it's really important to remember in the context of common law right of access claims and records that the nature of these records are records that the legislature decided should not go out under OPRA, which ultimately means they are the most sensitive of records, the most sensitive of information that we're dealing with. Because of that nature, they carry some of the highest risk when an agency or a custodian gets it wrong. We are dealing with all of the exclusions that we see in OPRA. We're dealing with victim names, witness names, proprietary information, trade secret information, information as this court considered in Gillibrand, security footage that will by definition, or may by definition, put buildings and people at risk. Because of these serious concerns, plaintiff and amici argue, as Your Honor, Justice Drabner noted, that their argument really boils down to we need common law fees in order to enforce compliance. But the truth is that holding the threat of fees over common law right of access claims may incentivize compliance, but incentivizes hasty compliance, which is in no one's interest, and least of all the public.
I missed, counsel, one of your categories, victims, information, proprietary information.
Witness names.
Witness names. Okay.
Trade secrets. Security footage, names of children, it could go on and on because everything is on the table when it comes to a common law right of access claim. It's everything, even those categories of information and records that are excluded under OPRA. The problem also with all of this is exacerbated, as this court has already recognized this morning, by the nature of the test that we're dealing with. Again and again, and rightfully, I've heard reference to the exquisite balancing test. But I want to expand on that just briefly for a moment, because we're not just dealing with an exquisite balancing test that is, as plaintiff indicated, frozen in time. This court recognized interests can evolve over time, and they often do. What we're dealing with in common law right to access claims are moving goalposts. And that's what really differentiates these cases and these claims from OPRA. There were questions, and I think Judge Sabatino, Your Honor, pointed out a number of possible exclusions, along with Justice Wiener after, explored some of the boundaries of OPRA. But part of the problem here is that at the end of the day in OPRA, what we're dealing with is a statutory scheme that has clear indications of what it's intended to do. And while that might have marginal edges that do need to be explored, it is still worlds away from the fluid and sensitive balancing test that is required under the common law.
If the court, though, either the appellate division in a published opinion or this court issues a precedential holding, has said, you know, under the common law, these are obtainable records. I mean, after a while, should there be some consequence for municipal clerks who are ignoring that precedent and just denying claims?
Well, and again, that is why the Attorney General in our brief did emphasize the fact that remedies already do exist at common law, including a remedy of bad faith attorney's fees, which asks whether ultimately a party's action or an agency's action was taken with an objectively reasonable belief in the merits of the case. That is the standard that the Appellate Division in JL put forward. And it's an appropriate standard, and it's an appropriately flexible standard to encompass the fluid and really the broad spectrum of situations. So in response to that hypothetical specifically, I would say that there would be a very good argument that if there is a categorical determination, and I want to be clear that categorical determinations in the common law are really fundamentally incompatible with one another, given the fluid balancing test to begin with, but if there was such a categorical determination, there would be certainly be an argument that the agency's actions were not objectively reasonable in terms of the merits of that case. And I think, again, to kind of return to something I just said, which is that categorical determinations and sweeping declarations like the one that plaintiff and amici asked for today are particularly ill-suited for the type of flexible balancing test that changes over time, that has moving goalposts, that depends so specifically on factors that are really outside of the agency's control. And by that, I mean there were questions asked about the types of requests that agencies field under the common law. An agency's balance under the common law, or the engaging in that balancing test, is only as good as the information presented at that time. An agency should be encouraged to work with requesters and vice versa. That is part of the principles of the American rule, is to avoid placing an undue burden on the courts. And holding the threat of common law fees over agencies will certainly incentivize hasty litigation from requesters, disincentivize agencies from continuing to explore as facts and circumstances evolve.
So you're saying that perhaps, to use one of your examples, if there was something, a building security request that could implicate safety in a building in the municipality, the clerk may be worried enough about being the catalyst to, wrong word, being responsible for a fee award and simply say, okay, they can have that surveillance.
I think that's unavoidable. I mean, if you, and you know, I know this court has heard a lot of personal anecdotes today, but I just want to offer that, you know, practicing in this area of law and representing an agency, the threat of litigation is always ever present. And OPRA comes part and parcel with that. It comes with its 7 business day timeframe. It comes with a rigid statutory, somewhat rigid statutory scheme that allows for that type of guidance. But the problem with allowing that or holding that over the head in a common law right of access claim is that, again, we're dealing with the most sensitive of records. And I'm not saying agencies are just going to start throwing records out the door, but it's a major additional threat that's ill-suited for the type of balancing test we're dealing with in the common law and the type of records.
So under Leugman and Rivera,
presumably the balancing test would focus, especially with the second factor, on what's the nature of the interest, why do you need it, why is it confidential, what are the possible ramifications, and that would be what the clerk would be called upon, and more, obviously, to engage in order to make a determination. And the clerk may just say, I'll avoid fees, just here it is.
I think it's unavoidable to say that we're injecting an additional complicating factor where one was never intended to be in the first place under the common law. And to Your Honor, Justice Rabner's question, we do put in our brief that the legislature chose to engraft attorney's fees onto OPRA and chose in not one but two places to leave the common law alone. And in answer to your question, Your Honor's question about what could the legislature have done, it certainly could have preempted the common law entirely and created OPRA in a different manner. Frankly, when trying to find guidance from different jurisdictions to see, you know, how other jurisdictions have treated this, including under FOIA, the truth is that most of those jurisdictions did choose to preempt the common law. Here in New Jersey, the legislature was very well aware of what it was doing when it created OPRA and left the common law alone.
With respect to the suggestion that the legislature could provide for attorney's fees for common law right of access claims, are you aware of areas where there's been a common law right that was left intact, as here, where the legislature nonetheless legislated with respect to the common law? It seems like there's
I understand Your Honor's question, but what I was suggesting is that the legislature could have chosen a very different statutory scheme.
I'm asking a different question. Oh, okay. I understood your argument.
Different
question. Could the legislature have imposed attorney's fees, the possibility of attorney's fees, for common law right of access claims?
I'm not aware of another circumstances where that had occurred. However, I don't necessarily see why the legislature couldn't have injected, or let me back up and answer that in a slightly different way, which is also answering Your Honor Justice Patterson's question, which is that the legislature has the authority to speak to what interests are advanced and that merit attorney's fees, whether they refer to it as the common law right of access, or they created something separate from OPRA, or they created something different. The legislature certainly has the authority to do that. But in answer to Your Honor's question, I am not aware of a circumstance.
Once the legislature speaks, their voice fills the void and takes the place of the common law. We recognize that. And that's why I'm curious about this hybrid that has been suggested to us.
Well, I want to be clear. The Attorney General is not suggesting a hybrid here. What we are suggesting is that the legislature was very well aware that in determining not to have OPRA fill the void in the common law and not to preempt it and to make that very specific decision, the sponsor statements, the public comments all make it clear that they were very aware that whereas OPRA, I think Your Honor Justice Patterson referred to it, was designed to be a law with teeth to provide those attorney's fees, that the common law right of access would remain as it was, which included the potential for expenses in litigation.
Is there an analogy there to what happened with consumer fraud? A statute's been around for a long time now. Ended up, obviously has a right of action. Ended up overshadowing common law fraud claims, but not eliminating them. And the legislature was silent as to any fee shifting in common law fraud claims, only dealt with its own statutory right. Is that analogous to what you would see, how you would see OPRA and the common law interplaying in this?
To be candid, I'm not totally familiar with the Consumer Fraud Act and how that functions, but what I will say is that I don't see an analogy between OPRA overshadowing in some way the common law right of access, because they serve different functions. And I think that the legislature was very, very well aware of that at the time it enacted OPRA. And there was a very specific purpose that OPRA was designed to fulfill. And I think it's clear from the nature of cases that have been brought under the common law that they are designed to serve two very different functions, and that in whatever way the legislature could have acted, which was to preempt the common law entirely while potentially subsuming part of its access or part of its records into OPRA, it decided not to do that. And I don't think I said that articulately, but what I mean is the legislature certainly could have swept, instead of making these categorical exemptions, it certainly could have provided for access. It could have provided for access in any number of ways and still engrafted fees into that statutory scheme, but it chose not to, with the awareness that that choice would result inevitably in litigation that could be expensive.
Maybe, and this probably is outside of your expertise, maybe family law is an example. Yeah, now I'm really causing a problem. But thinking of family law for a moment, you know, there are areas of family law, such as domestic violence claims, where there's a statute that the legislature injected, as opposed to marital torts, where I think the court rules and precedents on case law allowing fees to be shifted from one spouse to another fill the gap that the legislature did not encroach on. I mean, I don't know if that resonates at all with your argument, but it just occurred to me.
I think it does. You know, to the extent that the legislature chose in, for instance, domestic violence to make those decisions, I think it's a very clear indication from the legislature on what these public interests are. And even when this court has spoken in crafting exceptions to the American rule, they have largely been based on either, as I think Mr. Cohen indicated, there have been fiduciary duties, there have been breach of attorney, client relationships. There have been circumstances where this court in Re-Niles addressed, you know, what is a traditional element of damages under the restatement. But the point being that in the absence of the legislature indicating what it feels is important enough to be vindicated as a right to be compensated by attorney's fees, this court gets put in the position and gets put in the position of telling all of the courts to decide all of these questions. And I think you're on.
I'm not suggesting you would be intimately familiar with all of, you know, everything that's in Rule 419 in terms of types of cases where fees are allowed or other sort of discrete settings. But what is it that distinguishes this setting from the narrow areas in which fees have been allowed without a statute saying that fees should be allowed?
Without a statute? So
yes.
Just to, okay. In terms of this court's creation of exceptions to the American rule, the vast majority of them in Re-Niles Trust, VEDA, Lash, all depend on the commission of what is ultimately determined to be an intentional tort between parties who have a duty to one another. And this court has remained faithful to that, Inez as well. This court has remained faithful to that and has resisted departing from that, I don't want to call it a category, but that general pattern of adhering to those circumstances where the court exercises its authority to ultimately award attorney's fees. And I think that the distinguishing characteristic here is that what this court would be doing is precisely what Your Honor Justice Patterson noted earlier. And the question that would come is, where does it end? The court, the U.S. Supreme Court in Alyeska, cautioned against invading the province of Congress there. And here, too, the questions would come, is it a prevailing party or is it a prevailing plaintiff? We discussed redactions this morning. At what point do we award attorney's fees for something that was potentially redacted in error? Do we deal with why this interest? Why the interest under the common law? Why not a variety of other interests that the legislature has not spoken on? These are all the types of discretionary decisions and ultimately resulting abuses that the American rule was designed to stop. And what plaintiff asks this court to do today is to throw that door wide, wide, wide open and start that slope again. And that is why the Attorney General is taking the position today that we are asking this court to refrain from doing that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Woodward.
Thank you, Your Honor, and members of the court. It's a pleasure to appear in front of you today on behalf of the League of Municipalities, the Institute of Local Government Attorneys, and the New Jersey School Boards Association. I'd like to just go back to the facts of this particular case and why I think it creates a real problem. At the time, that is the position taken by the plaintiffs, At the time of the request, which was 5-6 years ago, the IAPP, the Internal Affairs Policy and Procedure, made the documents to be released, or that were requested, confidential. The argument of the plaintiffs in this particular case is that, well, the clerk should have been substituting its judgment for that of the Attorney General. The Attorney General's IAPP has the force of law. Yeah, and it's exempt under, you know, under OPRA, but also it's an outside agency. It's outside of OPRA. There's a command here that says you can't do this. You can only do it on the command of or direction of the Attorney General or the county prosecutor or upon court order. Well, that's exactly what happened in this case. And so the clerk complied with the law completely. And yes, there was a disagreement down the road where the trial court said, yes, this, you know, should be released. But the court did the balancing test, not the clerk. The clerk followed the law. Someone else decided, you know what? A judge said, this is something that should be released. We've done the Loigman factors, and here we go. The appellate division actually agreed, but the appellate division concluded that, yeah, but there was a good faith basis. Now, this was Mason, but even so, there's a rational basis for not turning it over at that point. Now, in the interim, in 2019, 2020, we have the Attorney General revising IAPP and issuing other directives. So the ground has changed. But in the context of this case, this clerk did exactly what the clerk was supposed to do and complied with the law. Now, with respect to Justice Patterson raised the issue of security cameras and things like that, a case that we cite, Path versus Garwood, there was a video of the clerk's area within the municipal building. And the police chief submitted a certification expressing grave concern about release of this video, providing people with access to or information about the security within the building. The end result was, and then there was also a more complicated issue, which related to, because there was a criminal proceeding of a police officer who had been involved in on duty going into the closed clerk's office and stealing things. There was a resolution of the case, and there was an expungement ordered entered, and the expungement ordered was interpreted at the time to bar the release of that video. The bottom line was, the clerk had two reasons for not releasing the video. The appellate division, the trial judge said, release it. I've done the balancing test. The appellate division agreed, but in that particular case, did not award fees, and did not award fees because there was no rational basis for doing so, that Mason did not abrogate the American rule, and there are therefore no counsel fees awardable under the American rule. The PAF plaintiff petitioned this court for certiorari, and that was denied. So clearly there was something that was at least correct enough that this court didn't feel that it was appropriate to get involved at this time.
What's your response to Mr. Cafferty's argument that the clerks are not being trained properly on common law cases because there's no incentive to do so?
Thank you for asking that question. As a league associate counsel, one of the things that I do is I provide training. And I can say that for the last 10 years, I, along with the director of the Government Records Council, have made a presentation with documentation and so on at the League of Municipalities convention. I did it this year for the most recent time. In addition, the two of us have also done at least three or four other such seminars, which are available to anyone who's a member of the league, and we've had, you know, very substantial attendance. And I might say that the presentations that I make cover all access to public records cases, not just OPRA, although OPRA is probably 90% of it, but even most recently in this November, I was talking about this case.
What percentage of existing clerks attend those?
I do not know. We have 570 municipalities. The presentation that I gave this year had in the room over 400 people. I can't say that every one of them was a clerk at all, but it was, they were well attended. And the others that we have done, including online ones during COVID, were attended by several hundred people.
So aside from the present, I'm sorry, Chief.
Is there mandatory training?
I can't say that it's mandatory, but there is CLE. There are credits like CLE that people get. In fact, one of the things that the League of Municipalities Convention is sign up for all these things so you can get your CLE stuff taken care of. So I don't know the specifics, but I do know that that individuals do sign up for this, and they do, or I assume, are required to do that if they want to advance. In fact, as mentioned by Mr. Cohen, in order for clerks to, you know, they to get their tenure, I assume they have to do that sort of thing. I don't know the specifics of it, but yes.
How do you respond?
That was the question I was going to ask, but with regard to the specifics of whether clerks are regularly getting this training, but maybe Mr. Carucci has more information.
Yeah, he'll follow me. I think he may know better.
How do you respond to plaintiff and plaintiff amici's argument that without the possibility of attorney's fees, there just won't be compliance with common law record requests because there are no consequences that flow from not complying?
You know, I was a municipal attorney collectively for 45 years, and I represented towns, and I know the dedication of the people that I have worked with in those various municipalities. And I can say that I'm kind of shocked when I see a municipal official not doing what the law requires. Now, maybe I'm just naive. We read about certain municipalities that have significant issues. But, you know, the towns that I worked in, I would say, and a request came in, we got the documents, we reviewed the documents, and we sent them out. As a matter of fact, the league, which this court has ruled is a public entity and subject to OPRA, we had a significant request this year, and we got it all done. I mean, it was very significant. It was like 300,000 documents had to be reviewed. So I say people are going to do their job. There's an assumption in that argument that bad faith is inherent in the actions of municipal officials. And I'm sorry, I cannot countenance that.
Take bad faith out of the equation. Are there consequences now for a town attorney to give advice along these lines? If it is ever a close case, just hold on to the documents, don't turn them over. Take the hypo and don't fight it.
Well, I'm thinking along the lines, and maybe I'm not getting directly to the point, but I'm thinking along the lines of the Lyndhurst case, dash cam videos. This court has ruled on that. Any attorney who's advising people for a municipality has got to be aware of that particular decision. And if a request comes in for dash cam videos, the clerk has got to know that more likely than not, that video is going to be released. And if there's a refusal to release that, well, then you've got what the Attorney General's office was saying is bad faith claims, frivolous litigation, that sort of thing.
I'm not sure that's the best example because it's an area that is now clear. My concern is you'll get requests in areas that are not so clear. Are there consequences if a town says, in all of those cases, we're just going to wait for the lawsuit? We're not turning it over.
Well, in one sense, we're here today because of that, but it's not bad faith. And, you know, as was said before, what I've understood from the arguments that we were getting in the briefs is it's better, their arguments are better presented to a legislative committee seeking to amend or modify the Open Public Records Act.
Other questions, anyone?
Any sense of the fiscal impact?
It definitely can be because the municipality has to defend it. There's one case I'm aware of where there was actually, from 2015, it was a law division case where a judge awarded $4,700 in counsel fees on a common law claim.
I think you may have been being asked about whether there'd be a fiscal impact of allowing common law attorney's fees.
The question, yes.
I'm sorry, then I misunderstood. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
If the court were to endorse a rule allowing fee shifting of common law, successful common law claims, what do you predict the impact, if any, would be on?
I think it could be significant. I mean, Mr. Cohn, I think, explained some of the impacts of this potential case. We heard Mr. Cafferty getting $600,000 in another case back in 19 whenever. So, I mean, I think, you know, if it's a few thousand dollars, it's not a big deal. But if it's $50,000 and you've got a 2% cap and you've got a budget that's being handled very narrowly, it could be very significant. And if it's a difficult issue that goes up, like one like this, where you have a policy with the force of law that the clerk follows, and then getting here to the Supreme Court and, you know, maybe losing, is very significant. I can't give you a dollar amount, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Carucci.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the Municipal Clerks Association of New Jersey as a friend of the court, and to encourage the court to see the issues presented from the perspective of the municipal clerk. All across New Jersey, hundreds of records requests are submitted every day at the municipal level. Handling each of those requests is a municipal clerk who also serves as a records custodian. They do their level best to respond to each of those requests promptly and correctly in compliance with the law. These dedicated public servants find no delight when access to a public record is later determined to have been improperly denied. When requests are made pursuant to OPRA, there's a good chance that the custodian will get it right, because the statute presumes access and it gives the clerk a roadmap. But under the common law requests are not so straightforward. As the Chief Justice's dissent in Gilleran versus Bloomfield indicates, the common law is much different. The scope is broader, a heavy burden shifts on the requester, and there's a complicated balancing test with no less than 11 factors and a delicate fact-based analysis. That test was designed by judges, and it's inherently a judicial analysis. Municipal custodians are not judges. Nearly almost none of them are lawyers. Yet clerks undertake that common law balancing test, doing so with real consequences to themselves and their employment. These differences between OPERA and the common law are not just theoretical, they are real. So if a municipal custodian happens to get it wrong, responding to a common law request, neither they nor their employer, their municipality, should be exposed or penalized to a fee shift. Now, there was some discussion by my friend on the other side, Mr. Cafferty, earlier about a survey. And I just want to correct the record. The survey was issued by the municipal clerks, not the League of Municipalities. Mr. Cafferty, I believe, misspoke when he said that the survey indicated that 97% of respondents were not familiar with the common law balancing test, and that 50% do not receive training. It's the other way around. The survey indicated that 97% of respondents didn't receive specific training on the common law balancing test by the municipality. As I'll explain in a moment, oftentimes, and Mr. Woodward explained, oftentimes the League of Municipalities provides this training. And so that explains in part that survey response. And in terms of the 50% who are not very familiar or not familiar with the common law balancing test, well, that is indicative of the complexity of the balancing test. As to Justice Patterson, your question about training and licensing, my understanding is that the Department of Community Affairs has promulgated regulations that requires clerks to be trained on a regular basis. I don't have, unfortunately, that specific regulation available as a site, but that is my understanding. So
is there now mandatory training?
Yes. My understanding is that there is, Your Honor, and that it's pursuant to rules promulgated by the Department of Community Affairs.
Is that being abided by?
My understanding is that, yes, it is, Your Honor.
Is either we heard that the League is not providing mandatory training. Is your organization providing it? And if not, who is?
There are educational components to our association, Your Honor. My understanding is it's a joint effort between the Municipal Clerks Association and the League of Municipalities. But we can be even more concrete, because if we look in the record in this case, and it's in the record of DA338, the municipal clerk for the Township of Neptune states in his certification that there are continuing education units that he must take to maintain his accreditation, and that he is a registered municipal clerk, that he regularly took courses at Rutgers University, at the League of Municipalities, and other institutions. This certification is very noteworthy for a few reasons, not just because it lays out that information, but also because it says that these courses frequently relate to OPERA, which is a topic of considerable importance to municipal clerks. And he says that as a result of his training, he's familiar with OPERA, both OPERA, and the common law right to access. And there's an emphasis, though, on OPERA, right? So, like other clerks, he was trained to closely observe OPERA's procedural requirements. So he notes he has an emphasis on OPERA. Now, this is a clerk who, at the time of his certification, had been a clerk for over 26 years, okay? And the fact that a clerk such as him or any other clerk may not have a specialization, a sophisticated specialization, like a member of the judiciary might, for example, on applying this complicated balancing test, I think is indicative of why it is so complex, why the court should proceed carefully.
Counsel, I just want to double back.
Yes.
Does your organization, the Municipal Clerks Association, mandate training?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is that it provides for educational opportunities, but in terms of a mandate for membership, I don't believe it is a function of that. I could be mistaken, but I think rather it is a function of the State Department of Community Affairs that is requiring continuing education credits on our members.
Rather than spend more time on this now,
yes,
can you and Mr. Woodward, with guidance from the clerk of the court, provide us a letter shortly that outlines what the mandate is?
Yes.
What regs exist, and we'll get you more guidance later.
Sure.
And whether it's being complied with, and if it's not mandatory, whether your organizations would contemplate mandatory training. Can't have you both speak at once.
We'll be happy to confer, Your Honor.
I'm showing a reference that was provided to me by Mr. Cohen on the footnote. The statutory mandated courses for municipal clerks are: 1, introduction to the duties of the municipal clerk, advanced duties of the municipal clerk, local election administration, information and records management, and municipal finance administration for municipal clerks, citing NJSA 40A:9-133.2.
Let's not try to do this now. I don't think it would be the most productive use of our time. But the critical... Not at all. I know you're trying to help. The critical question is, what kind of training is being provided on the common law right of access? And we'll flesh that out soon.
We'd be happy to provide that submission, Your Honor. If I could... continue on this complicated balancing test. There is really a collision of interests. It is very difficult to make the assessment, especially at that initial juncture. I know that there is some tension between the ACLU and petitioner on this point as to when the inquiry should be made. Should it be frozen in time when the submission is made? Should it be considered later? The point is, it is very fluid. And so it's just yet another reason why the court should not expand attorneys' fees to the common law right of access. Unless there are any other questions, I would like to simply conclude by saying that we ask that the court not expand attorneys' fees to the common law right of access, and instead, the court should remain faithful to this state's long and strong commitment to the American rule, and including, if need be, its limited exceptions, which in very rare cases might warrant a fee shift, but primarily those would only be, as counsel from the Attorney General's office said, when there is intentional misconduct. That is certainly not the case here, where the clerk of Neptune had a directive from the Attorney General's office, the chief law enforcement officer of this state, saying that the record that was requested is to be confidential. That type of record is to be confidential. And so we think it would expose and penalize clerks and their employers too harshly if they would be subject to attorney's fee awards in this setting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Gagliardi, batting cleanup.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd have to have a pretty good agent to convince me that batting seventh is cleanup, Your Honor. But I'll do my best to use my limited time to address two questions that have seemed to come up repeatedly in Your Honor's questions. Clearly, it's the position of the New Jersey State Associate Chiefs of Police that the American rule should be undisturbed and that fee awards should not be provided in the context of a common law request. But one of the reasons, and it was interesting, and I say respectfully to this court, rewarding that one at a time, each one of the five of you noticed the challenges of a six-part Loigman test and a five-part Rivera test imposed on municipal clerks or whoever the custodian of record is. From the standpoint of the chiefs of police, they would find themselves in a remarkably difficult position. As so eloquently argued by Ms. Gregory from the Attorney General's office, the Attorney General has promulgated IAPPs, which are binding on the state chiefs of police, so that there is certain information that should not, cannot, and must not be released as it relates to victims of crimes and the various examples given. On the other hand, these burdened municipal clerks unable to decipher these complicated tests, if there are attorney's fees to be awarded, more often than not will be in the "so what's the big deal" camp and release information that a chief of police would not want released and could not have released if they're going to be demonstrating fidelity to the IAPPs. This type of complicated balancing should not have on top of it the threat of fees, because your state association of chiefs of police is concerned that the balancing will not be the balancing envisioned by this court. It will be a balancing of what's the big deal of releasing this record versus what are the costs associated with us not releasing it under this complicated common law right of access. So we ask this court to recognize the implications of having information that the Attorney General's office has required law enforcement to maintain confidential, and how the clerk, burdened as they might be by their duties and their budget, might feel about simply releasing that information. So that's the balancing test we respectfully request this court to consider, because that's the real-world balancing test that's going to go on. The second point I wanted to make is this interesting interplay that the court was analyzing, where the common law sort of develops and then the legislature gets involved. And there was an example that I want to raise because it reflects that, and it reflects the way public rights can be vindicated even without an award of fees or damages. And that comes in the area of public bidding. So sitting there, of course, I can't remember the site offhand, although I know it's in one of those early white books. The case is Wazin versus the City of Atlantic City, and that was one of the early, if not the earliest case, considered by this court in the area of public bidding. And what it did was set up a scheme where bidders have to make a complaint about a potentially flawed bid advertisement in advance or waive that right. And that law developed over a period of time until it got to the point where the legislature codified it. And it's in statute right now that if you challenge an improper advertisement for or a bid award by a public body, you cannot get damages. So the most you can hope for is that if you are an interested party who didn't necessarily get the bid or were concerned you weren't going to get it, that they might repair the flawed bid award and award it again. But you can't get damages and you can't get fees. And I'm unaware of any argument ever made in the legislature or in front of this court that suggests the public bid laws aren't vindicated because you can't get damages and can't get fees. The questions, and Chief Justice Ravner used the word more than once, was consequences. How can we have a right that we value in this state without there being so-called consequences? Well, my respectful comment, not only to the members of the court, but everybody in this courtroom, is if you haven't been to a school board or municipal meeting lately, then you're not aware of the consequences that exist outside of the payment of money damages. Because the criticism leveled at public officials who consistently get things wrong is fierce, in person and online. So there was a discussion earlier about the prospect of being disciplined. Fun fact, if you get disciplined and you're a public official, it's private. If you're not good at your job and one of the things you get wrong consistently is not providing the public the information to which they are entitled, you get crushed by public criticism in person and online. So I don't know that we need attorney's fees to make sure that these important rights are vindicated any more than we need them for the bid laws and any more than we need them for the other ministerial but critical acts that public officials take all the time. There are many lawsuits of which I'm aware, mayors, councils, school board members face suits by average citizens who have no hope of getting attorney's fees, but they are tired of decisions being made incorrectly, people being appointed where they might not have the appropriate credentials. And public officials see that, and those rights get vindicated by citizens all the time. So I understand the pleas to this court to suggest that you have to do something when there's an important right and there's no hammer. There is a hammer, and it doesn't need to be fees. And if this weighing was going to take place, I respectfully request that it not take place here. I think there are many real-world implications in changing what has gone on, not because it may need changing, but this isn't the right spot for it. I think the collective arguments from the folks over here is it doesn't need changing at all. These public officials honor the common law right very, very faithfully. It's typically paired with an open request, which has the threat of fees anyway. And if someone was getting it wrong all the time, they would be subject to discipline and they would get hammered in not this court, but the court of public opinion.
Which I assume would potentially impact their job status, depending on their tenure status.
Absolutely would, even if they have tenure. I mean, you've heard the expression, driven out of town. I've seen it. That relentless public criticism every month, it's difficult to sustain. So there is a great deal of motivation to get it right and to use the Chief Justice's comments to deal with the consequences of not getting it right.
Thank you, Mr. Gagliardi.
Thank you, as always, for the privilege of appearing before the court.
Cafferty, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Yes, I negotiated with Ms. Griffin.
Negotiated your fee with her?
Yes. Based on that, I have a few seconds of rebuttal, if I may.
Yes.
First of all, I think there was a question asked earlier about whether any examples that may have been cited of fees being awarded under the common law. I would direct the court's attention to page 23 of our supplemental brief to this court, where we gave some examples of that.
Those are in individual cases?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
The Attorney General talks about, well, bad faith could be an exception where you could get an award of fees. And she, as I understood the colloquy, gave the example where you had a categorical exemption with no balancing. I just want to point out to the court that's what happened here. The trial court found there was no balancing, that the exemption was based upon the IAPP, and personnel records in the Vaughan Index indicates that that was the basis. So just factually, I wanted to point that out to the court.
Can you clarify one other point with respect to Mr. Woodward's argument? Was the clerk's answer consistent with the IAPP at the time that it was made?
That's interesting, because the clerk's answer was referenced the IAPP, and that was the extent of it. The Vaughan Index did not examine each record. Each record in this officer's folder, there was the record identification, and then the reason for non-exemption, there weren't even any redactions. The reason given was IAPP personnel records.
So is it your point that some of the documents may have fallen outside of the IAPP?
Well, my point was to address the Attorney General's argument, Justice, that even if you say there is no fee award in common law cases, there may be an exception for bad faith. And I think, as I understood the Attorney General's discussion, as an example of bad faith, the Attorney General suggested where there may be a categorical exemption basis with no balancing performed. And what I am saying is that's precisely what happened here.
I thought counsel for the Attorney General was saying that if the court rules as a categorical matter that a particular type of record must be disclosed, and then the clerks continuously refuse to disclose it, then that could be an argument of bad faith. Is that what you're saying happened in this case? That this
no,
was?
And if that's what the argument was, I apologize for misunderstanding it, but I didn't understand it that way, Justice. I understood that in a hypothetical situation, if there was such an exemption, a denial of access based on a categorical exemption with no balancing, that would be an example.
So the distinction you're drawing would be, let's use the security camera scenario, and the response of the clerk is security cameras are off limits, almost viewing it. We're handling it like it's an Oprah matter.
Right.
We just don't do security cameras, go away. You're saying that would be potentially bad.
Well, I'm saying, as I understood the Attorney General's argument, yeah, that would be an exemption, and maybe fees could be assessed there. And I am saying that's exactly what happened here. So even if you adopted that rule as a rule, in this case, there was a categorical rejection. based upon the
IAPP, but you're saying that some of it should have been produced and some.
Well, interesting, and that was a point I wanted to bring up to the court. What hasn't been discussed under the IAPP is, in addition to the fact that it can be released by the Attorney General, can be released by the county prosecutor, can be released on a court order, there's an additional line that apparently didn't happen here. In addition, the law enforcement executive officer may authorize access to a particular file or record for good cause. And while the IAPP, in effect at the time, didn't define law enforcement executive, it is clear from reading the IAPP that that's the police chief or the director of public safety.
So you're saying it's bad faith for the clerk did not go to the chief of police and say, you should release this?
I'm saying that the clerk did no balancing at all, didn't speak to anybody, just pointed to this document, the IAPP, and said, based upon this document, there is no access to the records.
You're saying that's should be subject
and, to... And that's contrary, I would respectfully suggest, to the decisions of this court, whether they be Leugman or Home News versus State Department of Health, which says a law, rule, or regulation is not dispositive of a common law claim. And that it, while it weighs heavily in the balancing, it is not dispositive of a common law claim and cannot be. And final point that I want to raise with the court is this court, and on the issue of the American rule, of course, has amended the American rule to allow fees, even in the absence of a statute or court rule, by judicial decision. We talked about Innis, and the court did it in Saffer on attorney malpractice cases, and did it as a one way. There is no ability of a losing plaintiff in an attorney malpractice to recover fees again, or for the defendant to recover fees. Finally, I just point to two provisions of OPRA in terms of the legislative acknowledging the court's authority to do that. NJSA 471A12 in OPRA says, the New Jersey Supreme Court may adopt such court rules as it deems necessary to effectuate the purposes of this act. It doesn't say this act, it says the purposes of this act. And the purposes of this act appear in 471A-1, and it says that the government records shall be readily accessible for inspection, copying, or examinations by citizens of this state.
Saying the legislature was telling the court that we have the authority to adopt court rules, that this was something other than court can adopt court rules to effectuate the purposes of OPRA in dealing with OPRA actions.
Well, it says the purpose. Well, I don't think it's so limited. It says the purposes of this act, and the purposes of this act are broader when you read 471A-1 than merely OPRA. I mean, the legislature recognizes that the purpose.
I don't know the answer to this, but has this court ever viewed that statute to apply to common law?
I don't think that issue has ever come up, but what I am suggesting is that the legislature, one can read that statute, is acknowledging on the part of the legislature that the court has the authority, including amending 44:42-9 by rule or judicial decision.
Is anyone disputing that the court has that authority?
Not that I have heard, Your Honor, except that there is some discussion, and was some discussion, I believe, that, well, the legislature could have provided for fees under OPRA this afternoon, and it chose not to do so. Under the common law, I apologize. And it chose not to do so. It just chose to preserve the common law. And what I am suggesting here is that the court, through this, the legislature, through this provision, recognize the inherent authority of this court to do so.
Which I haven't heard anyone dispute. So if I understand your argument, it's that the court has the authority to do so. You are not, and correct me if I'm wrong, arguing that the legislature can impose
No.
Attorney's fees in common law cases.
No. What I am arguing is that there was nothing in OPR that indicated that the legislature made a conscious decision not to impose attorney fees in common law cases, and in fact left it to this court ultimately in the development of the common law to decide that issue, which is before you today.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel.